CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com. It's Monday morning. I hope you're off to a good start today. It's just after 7 o'clock. We are live. Leanne and Sia are joining me in a minute. We've just tried to sort out our sound problems. Hopefully those have gone away. And I hope you had a good weekend. Tell us what you got up to. You can get hold of us on 079-748-2090. Okay, a few things. Here's someone, Carl, who says, "Dear Gareth, I can't believe you don't care about me. The only reason I listen is because I thought you cared. My shattered little soul." Okay, well, I care. If it makes you feel better, if it makes you sleep at night. Hey, guys, what do you think of the EFF going ahead with keeping all the Clicks stores closed today? Will they pay the salaries of the Clicks workers? The EFF would be angry if they used white women's hair as an example. They will turn any story into a race story. Yeah, I'm not surprised. I mean, I saw this. So someone on Twitter said, given Clicks made a mistake, imagine the EFF in power. If they're calling for 880 stores to be closed and 15,000 employees to lose their jobs over a mistake like this, imagine what they would do if they were in power. Scary stuff. Because the EFF has called for closure of all Clicks stores in South Africa over the story that Clicks put out this ad about black hair being dry and damaged and white hair being normal or whatever. So it seems like this is a thing for some people. Again, I think if you've got real problems in your life, this should be the last thing you're worried about. But it's so funny. Sia actually has a story about there's a woman called Jessica Krug. We'll talk about her in a second. Sia and Leanne joining me now. Hey, Sia, how's it? You back?
Ah, there we go. Yes.
Okay, hopefully sound is back to normal as well. So who is this Jessica Krug? Is she like Rachel Dolezal? Because that's what I understand.
Basically, that's the bottom line. She's a 2020 version of Rachel Dolezal. She is a professor who has been going on and on and on for years around blackness and research on black history. And then most recently, she released an essay on Medium on the 3rd of September entitled "The Truth and the Anti-Black Violence of My Lies." Where she basically admitted, admitted that she's a white woman.
You know, I think that we figured this out a couple of years ago, and it seems like we have to keep learning the same lesson over and over again because we're stupid. Race does not matter. If race is the most important thing in your life, either because a Clicks ad has upset you on a race basis or because you've been pretending to be black when you're actually white your whole life long, if race is that important to you, you're missing the whole point. We're all one species. This is uncontroversial. At best, this is what we should be teaching kids at school and turning them away from these nonsense arguments that help nobody. It's just amazing to me that, like, it's always these people in academia who are writing these, you know, the average white and black person in the world actually doesn't care enough about that stuff. They've got real issues to deal with. They've got to look after their families. They've got jobs to do. They've got things to care about every day that are actually important, that have consequence. And we live in the least racist time in human history. Really?
But beyond that, to me, it just says, oh, here's a crazy person. Because what makes you decide and wake up and go, okay, yeah, cool, I'm just going to be something completely different?
And by the way, if you are pretending to be black, like Rachel Dolezal or this Jessica Krug woman, because they're the same people who always talk about white privilege. If there's white privilege, why would you pretend to be black? That doesn't make any sense. It's the same people who talk about white privilege that pretend to be black or that talk about black issues. I love the way there's so many white people in universities all over the world who are writing about black stuff. I'm like, come on. Who are you? These white people who write about black stuff at universities in the US. It's just crazy. There's this woman called Robin DiAngelo. She wrote this book called White Fragility. And essentially the book is, I mean, it's just such nonsense from beginning to end. I've picked up little snippets of it here and there because honestly, if I had to read the whole thing, it would make me stupider. And she's written this book, which is like one of the best-selling books in America right now. And all it is a way for white people who've got great lives to feel bad and to channel their guilt into a book that makes them feel like they understand things when actually they're just guilty about their great lives. Because it's directed very much at like white liberal people on the West Coast or the East Coast of the United States who mostly have lots of money and great lives, and they live in the most prosperous time ever, and they pretty much don't ever encounter real difficulty. So that book is built, it is written to make those rich white people feel less guilty. That's all it does. So it's not helping black people. It's doing nothing for race relations. If anything, it's making them worse. But this Robin DiAngelo has written that book. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if she didn't have some mental health illness, some kind of problem, and that she wrote this book almost as a way to assuage her own guilt and her own problems. And I say problems with a small p in inverted commas because she doesn't have problems. She's in academia. Mm-hmm. So she's completely cushioned from the real world. And she's writing this stuff because it makes her feel better. She thinks that black people will go, oh, thank you, Robin DiAngelo. It comes from a place of superiority. It doesn't come from a place of genuine care.
So here's the tricky thing for me. As bizarre as these people's lives are, I also am slightly fascinated by, sure, okay, so if you want to be black so badly,
yeah,
go about your blackity black life then, you know, just go right ahead and, you know, just just be your average person in the community. They don't stop there.
No, they always have to tell everyone about it.
No, but they take up positions. Remember, Rachel Dolezal was the head of the NAACP chapter in her community.
Yes.
With this Jessica Krug, she based her whole career on studies of African and Caribbean cultures. She wrote a study called Fugitive Modernities. That won a prize in the 2019 Harriet Tubman Book Prize. As in, Harriet Tubman, great black role model.
Yeah, the civil rights leader. Yeah.
Even that whole panel thought, yep, she's a great black woman. And they gave Jessica a prize.
It's almost like it's a fetish. This is where I think it gets very murky. It's like they've got a fetish with blackness. They're a little bit obsessed with it in probably not a very healthy way. And these are white people who are fetishizing blackness. It's very concerning. And, you know, the other thing is, I mean, let's ask this question honestly, is why would someone who's living in a supposedly white supremacist country pretend to be black when they're actually white?
It's actually completely bizarre.
It's so bizarre. What happened to Rachel Dolezal? Have we heard anything about her since all that controversy all those years ago?
Well, she released a book that not a lot of people bought. Except me. I have made it through it. It's still in my lounge.
Wasn't she meant to come on our show at some point?
Yeah, she came to South Africa to do a talk. And then I was in contact with her people. And then she ended up not doing any interviews while she was here. Her parents disowned her somewhat. Her children didn't want to be associated with her. I watched her documentary and her children featured there, and you could just tell that her children didn't want to be on camera, didn't want the story to be told at all. So she sort of just faded into the background now.
She's like isolated herself from everyone.
No, she's not black or white now. Now she's just alone.
Now she's just a ghost, a see-through ghost.
She's just alone.
So this Jessica Krug, apart from being an associate professor at George Washington University and teaching as well on politics, ideas, and cultural practices in Africa and the African diaspora, she also has an alias that has also been sought out. She goes by another name, Jessla Bombalera, that is an online alias that has also released essays on her own over the past little while, and Jessla Bombalera is an activist based in the Bronx.
Okay, that so she's living
great
she's
work.
She's living out a fantasy life. This is like if I had a dream in my life that I wanted to be the Emperor of France, then I would live this bizarre double life in my head, and I would expect people to treat me like the Emperor of France, and I would write a blog as the Emperor of France. But actually, it's a fantasy that I'm trying to make desperately come to reality. It's just so sad. It's so sad.
Different. It's no different from wanting to be a fairy in the forest and live like that.
Well, but that's where these guys eventually and these girls eventually want us to go, is they want us to be, because you know there are these people who think that they're My Little Ponies. You know, they're these grown adult men, these fat grown adult men with purple hair and a beard. And they think they're a My Little Pony. And they want us to call them Pony or Rainbow Surprise or whatever the pony's name is.
Sweet Peaches.
Sweet Peaches. They want us to call them that. And if we don't call them that, then we are the bad people and we must actually be punished by the law for not treating them as pony kind. I kid you not. This is all on a spectrum from Rachel Dolezal, whose fantasy is to be a black woman. And she's fetishized blackness. Her is at one end of the spectrum. And then the pony guy is at the other end. And they're all just absolutely bored, which takes me back to the first hour. Mm. Find these four things in your life and you will never have to worry about being pony kind. Okay. Number one, find something to do. Number two, find a relationship with someone that means something to you. In other words, find someone in your life to care about and to be cared about by. Number three is get your body in shape, look after yourself physically, eat properly, do some exercise, etc. And number four, read something. Like read something real, not some person's thesis that they've made up from the Bronx. What was a Bombolero?
Just La Bombolera.
What a name. This is her fantasy. She's living in her head. She would prefer to be Jess Bombolera than she would herself. Shame. And she's a white woman pretending to be black in a country where there's so much systemic racism. Well, if there's so much systemic racism and so much white privilege, why would you want to pretend to be black, honey? And she's an academic. Again, the universities are filling people's heads with bullshit.
Isn't it also weird that these people out themselves? So in the Rachel Dolezal case, I brought it up after I watched the Rachel documentary that, you know, a lot of people think that Rachel Dolezal was interviewed and that is when she was ambushed with the question of, but is your dad black or white? When the documentary details the fact that there was a staging of someone who broke into the NAACP post box and was sending hate mail and racist mail, but it was later discovered through investigation that Rachel was the only person who had access to that post box. So
she was doing a Jussie Smollett.
You would assume that she was the one who was scripting these racist notes and email and sending them.
I have to say, when we start worrying about a clicks advert, and where Rachel Dolezal has to write her own hate mail, and where Jussie Smollett has to pretend to be attacked by two people he's paid to stage an attack on him.
And that's Jessica Krug releases her own essay about the fact that she's been lying about being black.
I would like to say that based on the four aforementioned cases, that we have an over-demand and an undersupply of racism in 2020. Now, I know there's racism. I'm not saying there isn't racism in the world, but it seems to me that the demand for racism, especially in certain political quarters, is greater than the supply. And I think that's something to be celebrated. I think we should all get over ourselves.
There's also a whole lot of desperation behind all
massive
this.
And boredom and lockdown and isolation. And listen, we're only going to start counting the mental health costs of this lockdown over the next 4 to 5 years. And let's be frank with each other. We don't know how big or how bad or how ugly it is going to be. But we already know that there are people who've committed suicide. We already know that there are people who are going through extremely tough times and very deep personal struggles as a result of being basically put under house arrest. for months. Now, if we have to turn this into something fun for a second, what fantasy would you have as a double life? Like this Jester Bombolero was this woman's fantasy, where she, like in her mind, her alter ego. Like if you could choose another life to live alongside the life that you've got now, and you want it to be a bit different, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you were able to have another personality that you could inhabit, would you choose a black woman in the Bronx like she did, Jester Bombolero, or would you choose like a king, or would you choose to be someone who lives on an island and surfs all day? I mean, that would be mine. Or a rock star, that would be my other one. What would your alter ego be that you would love to actually turn from fantasy into reality?
Probably to portray a life of luxury like Jeffree Star, although he's in a lot of hot water at the moment.
That's the makeup guy?
Yeah, so without all the drama, but just having this stupidly huge house that echoes everywhere you go because it's triple volume ceilings and you've got chihuahuas or something. Yeah, and you wear different wigs every day and you just live in this very shallow world.
So basically you'd like to be a gay makeup artist with lots of money.
Yes, probably.
Okay. All right. Well, Sia, that obviously wouldn't be your fantasy. What would your double life be? I mean, if you could just have, and you can go back in time as well.
So I would be, and no one can dispute it because it's my identity.
Sure.
I am the reincarnation of Queen Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
So I will rock
before her. Or after the husband died, because she was miserable after the husband died. Would you like to be her before?
Yeah, I could fake that. I could fake being miserable. I don't want anyone to share my wealth with.
Okay.
Yeah, I need to be a royal just so that I don't have to work and I just have everything that I need.
Yeah. Okay. Then we've got. Ooh. So I would like to either be a rock star or a surfer. That's what I'd want.
See, the surfer I get, the rock star, you still have to work.
No, but you're working doing. Oh, come on. I mean, you're working doing rock music. You're on a stage being adored by millions of people and you're singing great songs. I think that's an amazing way to live. And you're like partying all the time and you've got just endless supplies of beautiful women around you and you know, like just great. It's like a great life. A rock star is the greatest life. Who wouldn't want to be a rock star? I think that's the way. Look, so everybody has their fantasy. The difference between the fantasies that Leanne and Sia and I have just discussed with you and the person who thinks that they're pony kind is that we don't manifest our fantasy world in the real world because we know that that's an intellectual dishonesty.
Like Jessica.
Not to mention being generally a fraud in your life. I mean, I could pretend in my dreams and in my fantasies to be a rock star, but the minute I start thinking that that's the reality in my actual life and I start lying to people that I've written a hit song, or I go on a stage and I start singing and I sound like shit, that's where it's a problem. And, you know, the same goes for Rachel Dolezal and Jessica Krug and the pony kind dude. It's like, you just got to get over it. So Eleanor says she would like to be the ultimate Karen for a day. She'd want to scream at managers, bell the police, make her husband miserable.
Yes.
You know,
wear K-way jackets.
Eleanor, it's never too late. I mean, you know, that's a fantasy you can actually achieve in reality.
Yeah, it's pretty doable.
So apparently also KFC put out this ad. When you can't decide on a color, so you wear all of them on a panel with Steve Harvey, all these black women wearing different colors. And now people are like saying KFC must fall. And apparently they're racist for this post.
Flip.
Really? I mean, this is from Bihleng, who says this is just ridiculous. These people have no lives, and they're the most stupid people on Twitter. Take away Twitter from them, and they're dead. Well, I've always said, like, there should be a way that we can, the whole community on Twitter can vote, and if you've got more than 5 dumb comments on your Twitter timeline, you should just be suspended from Twitter for a year, and you can come back in a year's time when you've grown up a little bit. Maybe that's the way to deal with it.
But then last point from me on the story, please Google Jessica Krug or Krug and you tell me if she even looks black. at a push, if you squint, I would say she looks Latino. I don't know. And I've been scrolling for days looking for a picture where I can go, maybe
she doesn't look black.
That's the thing. Thought maybe she was tanning heavily on certain days. Wow. No.
Wow. I'm telling you there's a mental illness here.
I don't
I'm
know
telling
how
you
passed this.
We haven't got a word for it yet, maybe, or maybe there's psychologists and psychiatrists who have. But I'm telling you there's a disease going on here. It's like it's a fetishization of race.
Mm.
It's like they become, and I mean you can't be blamed in academia in the 21st century. This is all the rage. This is what gets people attention on campus. It's like if you can create some kind of, you know, some race grievance, then you help people. You think you're helping people, but you're really just helping yourself. And it would be really interesting if psychologists and psychiatrists and people who are studying this stuff scientifically as a mental health issue, if they could put together some sort of Rachel Dolezal, Jessica Krug, what's her Bronx name? De Bombolero.
Jess La Bombolera.
I love this. Please, can we have this study?
Now that, as Jess La Bombolera, she was also part Puerto Rican from the Bronx.
Well, here's something else. I mean, this is a point made by Ali. Ali says, this whole race faking thing also happens because these days we can't question anything unless we offend someone. Imagine her whole life, no one asked why she's pretending. Because she'd get, you know, obviously she'd be horrified and she'd be upset. She'd lay a complaint. That's probably why.
There's certain questions that you can ask to find out someone's blackness without being offensive.
The woke idiots, this is now according to Ruth. She says, these woke idiots are the most malicious, vindictive, and bitter people. What happened to all the anger about the black kid wearing a monkey top? No one is looking for that.
I remember that.
Remember that whole thing.
There was H&M.
Yeah. Everyone is looking for an extra race issue. You see, we're looking for these because I'm telling you, there's a huge demand for racism from certain quarters and not enough supply. That's why we have to make it up. Jussie Smollett, Rachel Dolezal. We're making shit up because we don't have enough. It's unbelievable. Who thought racism would be so popular in 2020 that we need to make up race issues like clicks ads? Do me a favor. Someone agrees with you here, Sia. Someone says these campaigns are deliberate.
I think so.
I mean, apparently Dove dropped an ad a couple of months ago about a skin and dry skin, and that also caused a race row. And turns out that might have been faked as well. It's just unreal. Like, come on, guys. You know that there are actually people who – there are real victims of racism in the world. It's just phenomenal how we choose to create a controversy where there isn't one and where there are actually people who are suffering from real racism. We don't seem to care about them. It's just mad. It's like the way the world turns a blind eye to women in Saudi Arabia. But they're terribly concerned about the glass ceiling in corporate America for women, you know? It's like, this is an acceptable one to get upset about, and this one you can't get upset about. And here's someone saying, also, Kanye Mbao is now white. She's looking white. Have you seen Kanye Mbao? She's, like, got blonde hair, and she's probably lighter than I am.
The carpets probably don't match the curtains.
Yeah, but she's not pretending. She's actually black. She knows we all know she's black. She's just putting on a little bit of white face.
So go ahead and read Jessica's essay. I don't have the energy to take it seriously, where she starts off by saying, to an escalating degree over my adult life, I've given up my lived experience as the white Jewish child in suburban Kansas City under various assumed identities within a blackness that I had no right to claim. First, North African blackness, then US-rooted blackness, then Caribbean-rooted Bronx blackness. I am not a culture vulture.
I am
a culture leech.
Caribbean bronze blackness. I like that.
Caribbean rooted Bronx blackness.
Oh, okay. Bronze. I kind of like that bronze blackness. I like the sound of that. I'm going to claim some of that through my grandmother. I've got a little bit of bronze blackness from the Caribbean.
Well, at least yours is like based on something credible and real.
Well, I don't know. She was a white woman, so I'm not going to. No, I don't want to go down that one. Where are all the children that stop and point out that the emperor is not wearing any clothes? Mm. This is pathetic. And Gareth, nobody is lighter than you. Thank you, Ruth. That's very nice. I am pale. That is true. But like one of the White Walkers from Lord of the Rings. I mean, what is it?
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones. Jesus.
Yeah, we're like Irish pale.
Yeah. Oh, man, I can't wait for summer. I get a bit of color. Then I can claim my Caribbean bronzeness. Listen to this story. You want to laugh?
In summer.
Yes. I'm so
sorry
excited.
That rhymed more.
So listen to this. Bristol University is about to police something they call diet culture and fat phobia and the language around it in sport after the student union denounced burning calories. Listen to this. I'm not making this up. This is a story from RT.com. That's the Russian news. Okay. Fake news, Russian news. But listen. You can actually ask Bristol University and they'll tell you it's true. Telling students at the gym to put effort into burning calories may soon be a banned approach at Bristol University. Its student union thinks this language promotes a thin privilege and causes eating disorders. The university will work with the union to conduct a full review of sports, exercise, and health messaging to ensure that it is not triggering, according to the Daily Mail. Staff members will undergo mandatory training on what to say during pep talks. Apparently, uttering something along the lines of burn those calories or work off last night's pizzas will be a no-no. This review comes in response to a motion passed by the university's student union, which blamed diet culture and fat phobia in Western culture for causing eating disorders. Almost one in every five students at the university thought they might have an eating disorder since starting their course. The common perception of slim bodies as healthier and more attractive compared to plump ones generates a thin privilege, believes Tory Friedman, the leading sponsor of the motion. What's the bet Tory Friedman is some spoilt girl whose parents sent her to university because they couldn't find anything for her to do and she's too lazy to work?
She was a sorority girl.
Yeah. And she's probably thin. That's the funny thing about this is she's probably thin. And then she's making this up. You know, it's just the minute we start doing this, we are in huge trouble. We are finished as a species. Don't fill people's heads with nonsense about how the language is hurting you. If we say you're burning calories, that's some kind of insult. The fact is, if you are a big, fat, plump mess, you are going to die sooner than someone who's got a healthy body. That's not society. That's nature. Nature is against you.
Can you imagine being on this whatever type of union or whatever she's creating? It must be exhausting.
You have to constantly think about what you're going to say three times because
yes.
Everything you say is going to upset someone, right?
I just Googled Tory Friedman.
Oh my gosh. I heard I was at the pharmacist and I was speaking to the pharmacist and there was someone next to me speaking to another pharmacist. And she said, I did get this medication. I got it from one of your other pharmacists who works here. And the man said, can you maybe describe him? And she said, he was tall. He was lean. So the pharmacist said, tall and lean. That's very odd. She goes, Ben, the black guy.
See?
And how... Yeah, it's back to that whole thing of how we're so scared to call something what it is, you know.
Okay, but I get it. I have sensitivity. I'm nervous about that. I would say eight things before I say, you know, I'd say Leanne, you know, Leanne with the long hair, Leanne with the glasses, Leanne with
instead of just saying the fat white chick with goggles.
I'm not putting myself in that. No.
It would be so much easier.
You know, here's the funny thing is like once you actually care about someone, like I've known Leanne a long time, right? Mm. How many years is it now, Leanne? It must be like 15, 20 years,
something
maybe.
Like that, yeah.
So I've known her a long time. So if I say to Leanne, like, because she knows there's no malice attached to this. Like if I say something about, you look like you've had a good weekend of eating, She's just going to laugh at me. Now, it may hurt on some level, but she knows that it's coming from a nice place. It's not coming from someone who genuinely wishes her misfortune.
Mm.
And it's so funny that we will treat strangers better than we'll treat the people we love. Like, we'll watch out for strangers' feelings, but somehow it's considered like you reach a certain point where you're comfortable with someone, where you can actually joke about the way they look. Like, you know, we were joking about how pale I am just a couple of seconds ago. And Of course, paleness is not as sensitive an issue as weight. But the fact is, like, I can talk about people being overweight on the show, and Leanne's not going to finish the show and cry to herself that Gareth was mean to her. Because we've reached a point of honesty, you know? And that's worth more than me not offending her on purpose and walking around issues. I feel that way about, you know, the black people I have in my life who I love and respect and care about, where it's no longer about their blackness. And if Rachel Dolezal, God forbid that I ever need a friend like Rachel Dolezal, but if she was my friend, I would hope that I would be able to say to her, hey, Rachel, you're not even black. Because that's where the bullshit starts. It's like we're so politically correct, we're so scared of offending each other, that we don't say something to someone like Rachel. And so her lie grows and grows and grows. And eventually explodes, and it causes huge shit for her. And her life is a disaster. And no one talks to her anymore, her kids, her parents. Imagine the misery that woman's going through. I wouldn't be surprised if she kills herself, because her life is so horrible now. And it got to that stage because no one was prepared to be honest with her. Hey, Rachel, sit down with me. Let's talk about this for a second. I care about you. I think it's very unhealthy that you're pretending to be black. And she'll go, how dare you? I am black. Blah. But eventually, maybe, if you can reach a point, maybe after a few drinks or whatever, where you're talking honestly to Rachel, Don't you think that you'd reach a point then where you'd actually help her and she'd help you and you'd get along better? She'd have someone who cared about her in her life?
Maybe, but I think some people are lost causes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to make this effort with Rachel. She's not a friend of mine. But if I were her friend, wouldn't it be incumbent on me to tell her the truth? Like, if I saw...
Then it's the whole thing of, is it your place?
And... Yeah, I know that. But if you really are close, I'm not close to her, so I wouldn't ever do that. And I don't even correct my friends on minor things unless they ask me.
Unless it's grammar, then I'll correct everyone.
Oh.
Unless you what?
Unless it's grammar.
Oh, yeah. No, you're a grammar Nazi. So that's a different story. Anyway, there's a very happy story for this morning, which I think, you know, people always, we all are concerned that we don't have enough. We might not have enough money. We don't have enough friends. We don't have enough relationships. We don't have enough, we don't do enough in terms of health and, or, you know, anything to do with our mental health, perhaps. But the reality is, like, you sometimes have to count your wealth in strange ways. There's this kid who has been getting 28 years of birthday whiskey gifts. Like, people have been giving him whiskey for 28 years of his life as a gift. I mean, maybe it's a family tradition or whatever, but it's really good whiskey.
Yeah, so he's actually 28 now. Every year of his life, so even from the age of one, His father gave him an 18-year-old whiskey. Okay. And this guy he was born in 1992, and over the course of his life, his father has spent about £5,000 on 28 bottles of Macallan single malt. The collection is now worth more than £40,000 and has been put up for sale. You know, this guy says it probably wasn't the best gift for a young boy, but the bottles were received with strict instructions never to open them so that they could become a nest egg. And this collection is absolutely beautiful. I mean, you've got bottles from 1982 onwards.
Wow.
And it's a complete collection. So he says he did manage to, he said he had to try really hard not to open any of them, but he managed. So he's now selling these. So The first bottle was a 1974 whiskey.
Yeah.
And that was bought to wet the baby's head,
mm-hmm.
which is like a traditional gift. And the Macallan, since he started buying it, the Macallan collection has increased in value, whether it's old or not. It's just become, the value of Macallan has risen hugely over the last 5 to 10 years. And so to have a full collection is just really amazing.
And so for not selling this stuff and not drinking it,
yeah,
he can now sell it all at once. And you said what, 40 grand?
Yeah, £40,000. So he can use the money wow. for a house deposit. And there, the broker who's actually selling it, a whiskey broker, says he's described this as a perfect set. There's wow. already been a lot of interest in the collection, mostly from buyers in New York and Asia. So it's actually quite a unique idea if you are a dad of a new child now to start doing this. I don't know, it's quite unique.
Absolutely.
Lots of value in it.
So you see, you might be getting something that you think is probably, like, what does a five-year-old care for a bottle of whiskey? And especially a 15 or 20-year-old, you're so tempted to just drink it because it's alcohol.
Yeah.
But you see again how if you defer the gratification to a later date, now he can pay for the deposit on his house. That's amazing.
It's like those ads and that test that's become a sort of viral thing now, where you give a kid one marshmallow and you say, if you don't eat it now, then you can have two later.
Mm-hmm.
And instilling that sort of value.
Yeah. You get the kid used to delaying gratification, and then they end up being much more productive and successful adults. Now, it's hard. Maybe. Don't get me wrong. You give me a chocolate or whatever and tell me to hold on to it for a week, I'm going to be like, no, thank you.
Gives me some hope. Maybe I need to get the full collection of Tupperware my mother gave me valued.
Well,
it's a full set in four different colors. Hey.
Yeah, you remember we spoke about this with Gord, and there are different kinds of Tupperware, man. You could be sitting on a fortune.
It's the actual dish plus the lid. We know how those lids go missing.
No, if you've got all the lids, it's a valuable collection.
Have your parents ever given you anything? Like family heirlooms or collections?
Yeah, they've been a few.
I got a nice fat check on my 21st birthday.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
You know, there used to be a family tradition in our family of napkin rings with your name on it in silver.
Oh, yeah.
I think that was like a first birthday present that was given by grandparents or whatever. So I've got a couple of those, but they're all at my mom's house. I mean, I don't use napkin rings. You'd put a napkin inside this thing, but it would be made of silver and, you know, have your initials on it or whatever. So there were those when we were kids. Been some paintings, and I know that I gave my two nephews a silver Kruger Rand each. So that will probably have, in fact, I know that's increased in value because the silver price has gone up. So just based on the market price for silver at the moment, that'll be worth something. But you know, it doesn't have to be something really expensive. It doesn't even have to be something that's obviously valuable. I mean, you know, if you buy someone a gold coin, or a set of coins from, you know, the South African Mint, for example, those will obviously increase in value over time. The metal itself is worth something. And then because it's a set and it hasn't been opened, and I mean, my brother collects all kinds of bizarre things like toys and things. I collect swords and daggers. And it depends. I mean, everybody's got something that you never know what that collection might be worth. Books. I mean, I have tons of books at home. I have a set of books up here behind me on the shelf that I actually bought that come from Jan Smuts's private library.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're signed in the front by him and his wife, which must be worth a fair amount of money. But I wouldn't sell them. It's more important to me that I have them. So this guy might not want to part with those bottles of whiskey. He might want to hold on to them. It's like this is his life told in whiskey, you know?
Yeah. But there's also the risk of doing something like this and it doesn't end up being of any value at all.
Sure. I mean, yeah, you could collect chewing gum and then find out that that's worthless.
Yeah.
No, not
used. Or you pick a certain whiskey brand and it ends up becoming completely null and void and uninteresting by the time you want to sell it.
Yeah, they go out of business because they make shit whiskey.
Yeah.
Although even then it might go up in value. You don't know. I mean, I do think that you've got to look when you give someone a gift. It's always nicer if it's something that's permanent, which is why I don't like giving cash and I don't like going onto those gift registers, because I always think, you know, I'd rather give you a handwritten letter and something that you can keep for a long time and give you something that is an appliance that's going to break in your kitchen. I mean, my parents, for example, they found something the other day in their, I don't know if it was a dinner plate or something else, but it was given to them at their wedding. I was like, shit, here you are almost 45 years after your wedding and you've got something and you remember who gave it to you. Well, that's quite cool.
Yeah.
If I think back to, you know, presents that people have given me over the years, there are very few of those presents that are still around.
That's cool.
It is quite cool. Like, it makes it feel like something is there for a very long time and it's special. All right. Well, we've got to get on with things here. We've got lots to do this morning. I've got some emails and some comments from everybody. I'm sorry about the sound problems. We're going to figure that out. Try and make sense of all of this so that we don't have any problems tomorrow. But it is time for us to get into our feature with Saika. Saika, you know, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. And we're going to speak to someone called Jean Fulyun, who is the project director there. Now, given the recent accounting and auditing scandals that you've obviously read about in the news, there's lots to talk about. And this is by no means just a discussion of Saika and what they do, but it's also a way for us to figure out how we can improve the quality and the credibility of South African accounting. And to talk about this, we speak to Jean Fulyun, and you get to hear it live with us this morning on cliffcentral.com. I hope you're having a good day so far. We will be here tomorrow morning bright and early at 6 o'clock, but don't miss that when we start up the show, fire it up and get going first thing in the morning. And also through the course of the day today on cliffcentral.com, plenty of really good stuff, including an interview with a guy called Richard Hardy, who's the CEO of Knight Frank South Africa, a global perspective really on prime property and wealth. I think this might interest many of us. And it was recorded in May of 2019, but there's a lot of that information that's really interesting to look back on now, especially because we've learned about what coronavirus has done to the property market. So all of that on the way. Here is Jean Fulyun, the project director at Saika.
Cliffcentral.com.
Whether you call them bean counters or those who crunch the numbers, you can't get past the importance of efficient accountants. So if you run a business, you get to have a voice in hiring of staff, or as an accountant yourself, do you know the benefits of belonging to a professional body? Be Accountable is a progressive pathway to accounting excellence. It's brought to you by SAICA, that is the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, South Africa's foremost accountancy body and one of the leading institutes in the world. Now, given the recent accounting and auditing scandals in South Africa, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants have increased their focus on ethics and on ethics training in the pre- and post-qualification education space. Jean Fulyun joins us today. She's the project director at Saika, and she's here to elaborate on what exactly Saika is doing to address this issue. So first of all, Jean, I always used to think when I was at varsity and when I started off in business, like, accountants are the people you can always go to for the facts because they deal with audits, they deal with balance sheets. They're not the people you have to be concerned about, but there have been some situations in South Africa recently where we've seen irregularities pop up. We've seen places that have been run badly. Obviously, ethics are an important part of any profession, but in accounting, it's almost more important, right?
Yes, very much. And hi, Gareth. Thank you for having me today.
What a pleasure. So tell me how you, first of all, started your journey at Saika and how you got into the position that you're in now as project director. Because obviously that would inform many of us on how exactly it comes to be that ethics becomes such an important part of what we all do, and in particular what accountants do.
Yes, Karen. So I'm actually a chartered accountant myself. And before joining Saika, I was a member in practice, being that typical accountant doing the books and everything. So I started with SACA about 4 years, almost 5 years ago, as a project director for practices, and recently taken over the portfolio of ethics as well. And being such a core part of being an accountant, it's such an exciting road and opportunity to talk to our members and to the public about ethics specifically.
Right. So tell me, when you were just an ordinary member of SACA, and did these things come up as great concerns for you, or was it really only in the light of what's happened in those very high profile cases that we've read about in the media that you started thinking, oh, okay, well, there's quite a lot of work to be done here. It's not just about being part of a professional body and, you know, having the ability to refer to other professionals and being registered and being properly endorsed and qualified and all that stuff. It's only after, probably for most of us, we heard about bad practice that we started thinking about it. Is that true for you as well?
No, Gareth. It's actually being ethical and is kind of such a core of being a chartered accountant. We get taught this from very at the beginning when you start choosing this direction of being a chartered accountant, uh-huh. with the basis of being the code of conduct, which is actually an international code that as SACA, the professional body, is adopted as a SACA professional code of conduct. So such embedded actually within us as a chartered accountant. And you get dealt with, or you deal with ethical dilemmas basically on a daily basis, and how you need to be prepared for these types of things. And that is what you get taught. It's not just the theory. It's being the practicality and understanding this. Yeah, I must say, with the recent scandals and everything that's gone in the media about the accounting profession, I think it's come to light a lot more. But as a chartered accountant, you are so wary or so kind of aware of ethics, that because it's such an embedded within you.
Mm-hmm. So the media has reported many accounting irregularities, and the perception is that there's a lack of ethical leadership in the accounting space. Now, why is SACA's approach to ethics training important here? And how does your experience there help other people to figure out the way forward?
So Gareth, maybe to answer that question is kind of referring to back to where you kind of get to know about ethics, choosing as this path as a chartered accountant. So our approach at SACA is actually starting at the grassroots, even from school level, for those learners that want to take up accounting and why they should choose it, and actually what it means to be ethical and what does ethics stand for. We also talk to our members, or the coming up members, as being in the academic side and studying towards accounting and studying towards being a chartered accountant, to have our academics, those people, those professors, to have the right ethical vocabulary, because mm-hmm. we need to talk the language.
Yeah.
You need to understand what it means. So those that need to teach ethics needs to understand this, so that the students understand this as well. But you can't teach ethics separately. It's not something that you put in a box and you kind of delve into that box when you need to. It's kind of embedded in everything that we do. You spoke about auditing, corporate mm-hmm. reporting, tax, everything. You need get dealt with these types of dilemmas on a daily basis. So you need to know how that ethical element fits with all your technical competencies as well. So you get taught that as a student.
I think that's a terrific way to answer a very complex set of questions, in effect, because really, you know, SACA can't do everything, but it does encompass so much of what goes on before, during, and after anyone is qualified, once they've started their first job. And there are obviously many moving parts in these things. But you guys expect your members to continually do professional development, right? I mean, that's part of what they do. So does ethics form a part of that continuous training as well?
Yes, it does, Gareth. And we believe in a lifetime, to obtain this attitude and skill of lifetime learning. And we refer to the CA 2025, although looking at 2025, not only on that here, but having a point in the future that how you should be equipped as a future accountant. And ethics plays a very cool role to kind of component to this, sorry. It is our lives are changing so rapidly. If you start thinking about the digital acumen and the technology around it, but in the broader sense of ethics, but not ethics as a technical side, like I said, but also being a citizen and lifetime learning and adapting or to all of these changes, that is what you as an accountant need to be. And like you said, we are a SICA with all our membership designations. We believe in developing responsible leaders that behave ethically.
Yeah.
And creating the sustainable value to all of the stakeholders involved. And it's an integrated way of thinking. It's not just, like I said, thinking in components and not just dealing with the balance sheet or the income statement, but how it embeds and how you interpret and actually add value to your clients.
Who do you think the bad guys are? Or do you think, because nobody really sees themselves as bad, do you think that what happens is that someone somewhere lets their standards ethically slip just a little bit, and then that opens the door for other people to start letting their standards slip? And as you see that happen around you, even really, in inverted commas, good people are suddenly bending the rules, and they suddenly doing things that they know they probably shouldn't be doing, but because it's happening all around them, it's part of the culture.
I don't think so, Gareth. I think as a chartered accountant, it is such a core of who you are, and it's such a few handful of people that is actually transgressing or causing this waves in the profession. Mm. It's a sense that maybe just a little bit of statistics. We get about 240 cases reported to SICA of about 50,000 members of possible unethical behaviors, but it's not all of them are. It's only a handful that these situations is. So I don't think it's like you feel that one person is slipping up and I can do that. As an accountant and as a chartered accountant, you live by these five principles that's embedded in the code, and it's professional behavior, integrity, honesty, independence, and having the competency to deal with the type of task that you have those capabilities of doing that. So I think it's not that you see around everybody is doing wrong, that okay, it's fine in that sense. I think it's only a few that make the decisions and all get kind of judged by that point.
Well, I think it's great that you guys are as thorough about what you expect of your members, and that you continue this education as a very important part of this. But are there other things that SICA is doing in the ethics space that we should know about?
Yes, Gareth, there is. And I must say, these are the two things that I'm very, very excited about personally. Mm-hmm. So one of the strategic pillars of SICA is relevance and reputation, adding to our member value. And it's kind of having a look at enhancing the trust and the credibility in the profession. So the two projects that we are currently with is called the Integrated Ethics Plan and the Audit Reform Program. And the Integrated Ethics Plan talks directly to the point that ethics is not a standalone thing. It's something that's embedded in everything. And it's not just King for or the code or things. It's how you live your life, the business ethics, the personal ethics that you have, and how everybody around you, the whole chain of people involved, needs to kind of embrace ethics. The audit reform is more specifically to the auditor's profession, and but it's not just auditors. It's the whole chain, like I said, the internal auditors, the board, the people that is involved in this chain has all the responsibility to uphold ethics.
Right.
And these are the where SICA is currently engaging and being a thought leader in the specific areas, mm-hmm. to enhance ethics and having it front of mind and actually live ethics, not just speaking it. And these are the ways that we kind of influence and working with other stakeholders, whether it's the independent board of regular of the auditors, RBA, sorry, or whether it's with government, is how we all position ourselves, and we all have a role to play, even as a public, within the space and report on ethical behavior. It's not just one person's responsibility, it's all of ours. And that's where I think it's such a crucial part that as psyche, we play this space and we kind of involve all the role players to think more ethically.
Well, thank you so much for your time and keep doing the good work at Psyche. I'm very, very pleased that we've got people like you running, you know, the project director role there and being able to infuse the professional body with all the necessary enthusiasm that it has to have in order to keep moving ahead and to keep moving ahead ethically. It's very good of you to spend some time with us today. Thank you, Jean. Be Accountable, a progressive pathway to accounting excellence brought to you by Psyche, the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. CliffCentral.com